This is the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Hi, hello and welcome to the Urban Astronomer Podcast. My name is Alan Farsfeld and I am here to welcome you to the 11th episode of a show that is now definitely in its double digits. Yes, we're all grown up now and it is time to give a heartfelt thank you to everybody out there who has agreed to be a guest on the show, everybody who has left comments to give feedback or offer corrections or just giving their encouragement. Thanks to everyone who's ever shared a link to an episode or told a friend about us. And in fact, thank you to everybody who just listens to the show for making a bit of time in your busy schedule to download these recordings and play them through. I listen to a lot of podcasts myself, and I find that I've got to regularly prune my subscriptions list in order to just to have enough time in my commute to listen to everything it downloads. So the fact that I'm still on your list, well, it's humbling and it's flattering all at the same time. You totally so totally rock just for that. Anyway, you might have noticed that we've been doing a lot of interviews recently, and I'm afraid it looks like we're continuing in that vein for a while still. This week's guest is Martin Hagen, who is a severely underrated South African-born astrophotographer. I say underrated because his work is frankly beautiful, yet he doesn't seem to have achieved that household name status yet of other top photographers. I suspect that it's because he simply hasn't been at it that long. Reputations take time to build. Whatever the reason, I'm pretty sure I could learn an awful lot from him, so I definitely recommend listening all the way through this recording. What is your background in astrophotography? Because some of the images of yours that I've put on the on the Image of the Month page on the ASA website and that I've seen on your Flickr accounts, they're quite amazing. Are you new to this, or?
I'm fairly new to astrophotography, but not to photography. I work in the creative industry, more in special effects and animation for television. But when I studied, photography was part of my course. So I sort of developed a passion for especially nature photography early on, and I've been doing that for a lot of years. And when it got to a point where I realized that you could take an average camera and stick it on a small telescope and get amazing results, I was keen to investigate that. So I've only been at astrophotography for about 2 years now. But yeah, I enjoy it immensely, a lot of my other work was, I've always just been fascinated by nature. And so I've done everything from macro or extreme macro photography. And what I enjoy now is the opposite. Now instead of looking at something really small, you're looking up at the night sky and photographing, amazing objects that you can't see with your eye, or that most people think that you can only see, the Hubble telescope or something. So yeah, I've enjoyed that whole journey of discovery, getting into astrophotography as well.
I got to say, it's something I've noticed is people like myself, for whom photography was a way to, capture memories of holidays and so on, starting from that background, it's a very steep learning curve getting into astrophotography and getting images that you're proud of.
Yeah.
But if you've got a background in photography already, it's people like professional photographers, they seem to pick it up really quickly.
Yes, I think because such a lot of it comes down to understanding cameras and technical aspects. Now, there's a whole different side of, of the learning curve that I still had to go through, which is, what everyone struggles with when they start is just to get a good alignment and, those basic things, because they're all new concepts. But the photography background definitely helped, because you still end up in Photoshop when you're done, and having studied graphic design, I started with Photoshop 1 actually, on a little black and white Apple Mac, nearly 20 years ago or something. So I've been using it for like 20 years or more. So even though the kind of things that you do in Photoshop for astrophotography is vastly different from what you would do to a regular photograph, you know, the underlying principles are sort of the same. So I think that's where it's, that part of the process is quicker, you know. But so that definitely did help a lot. But, you know, initially the biggest learning curve for me was just to, you know, all the little technical things that you needed to do to get the mount lined up correctly. And before you could actually take a photograph that was worth editing, you know, and, you know, but it's been a very interesting experience and very rewarding because you have to fight for every image.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, it's sometimes you have to travel far to get to a dark site. You know, you spend hours in the cold and, you know, you come back and it takes hours to process. But then if you get something, it's extremely rewarding. So that's what I enjoy about it, actually.
Talking about going to Photoshop from version one, I mean, was that, were you working with photographs or was that more of a graphic design type work? Or and was it transferable skills, what you would do to bring out the highlights in a dark night sky photograph or, say, a Milky Way shot or a deep sky or something? I mean, I don't know any of those techniques, and I get very different results with my work, so...
Yeah, I mean, the what I found with Photoshop, and luckily, again, there's something like YouTube where you can go and find some very interesting channels that show you how to use Photoshop for astrophotography. And it's not the only program I use. I start off by going through PixInsight, and then I end up in Photoshop. Just because they're good at different things, like there's pros and cons to both. And I like to mix. And initially I had to experiment because no one's workflow is exactly the same. But what I found, or what I wanted to achieve, was to get to a workflow that I could repeat and get similar kind of results every time I do the same thing. So that was quite important for me, even in my setup that I've got and the kind of gear that I invested in. It's not top of the range stuff, but it's, I wanted to get to something that I knew I could align the stethoscope every time and get it spot on, the knowledge I had, you know, still learning. And the same for Photoshop. And a lot of the normal photography terminology you can pull through and the tricks that you use. But I also found that it works the other way around. Interestingly enough, even though I, you know, I've been doing macro photography for years, there's sharpening techniques in astrophotography that I learned in Photoshop, which is something I never saw until I started looking at astrophotography tutorials, that I've now, that I'm now applying to my macro photography. It's basically something they call wavelets, that basically it breaks down the image and the text structure of different sizes, and you can apply different sharpening at different levels. But the great thing about that is it doesn't introduce noise. Now, if you just in Photoshop, if you just use the standard sharpen filter, you will add noise over your whole image, which is not what you want. So this is, you know, the interesting thing is what I realized soon was that even though I thought I knew Photoshop really well after all these years, there was a lot of creative ways that the guys in astrophotography found to get around problems. And I wasn't familiar with those techniques because you never really use those techniques, or you don't need to use those techniques in traditional photography because you're not stretching your image as much. You know, you've pretty much on a normal photograph have a good exposure, and you don't have to stretch your histogram a lot to get all the faint detail out and things like that. So, you know, it's a bit of a different workflow, but as a result, because the program is so flexible, they've played around and came up with techniques of achieving certain things without the drawbacks that, in the case of sharpening, a sharpening filter would have. The interesting thing is when you go back then to traditional photography, those same tricks still work on a normal photograph. So now I found, after years of using Photoshop, I've now found a better way of sharpening my macro photography, which is exactly the same technique I use for astrophotography. You know, little things like that. So that's what I found interesting. A program that I thought I knew really well was being used in a completely different way because the images demanded such a, different approach. So certain things overlap and certain things are just completely unique to astrophotography.
What equipment do you use? Camera, telescope, etc., and mounts?
At the moment, I think it's probably one of the cheapest possible astrophotography setups, especially when I started out. I did a bit of research spoke to a few people, and which is very important. I still made some mistakes with my first purchase, but everyone was basically saying, the mount is the most important. If you spend your money anywhere, spend it on a decent mount. And look, my version of a decent mount isn't really a decent mount. It's a decent mount in our currency. Yeah. So I basically bought what I could afford, and I ended up going for Celestron Advanced VX, which was, a fairly reasonably priced German equatorial mount, which is very important if you want to guide and, especially for astrophotography, it helps if you have a equatorial mount. So, that was one of the first things I invested in. And then I actually got a really cheap telescope. My first telescope was a little GSO 6-inch Newtonian, so it's quite small. It's easy to, it doesn't need a heavy-duty mount or anything. And when I bought it, initially I planned, because all my wildlife and nature photography I shoot with Nikon, I've just always found that. So you pick a brand and you stick to it because, all your lenses work on it and you don't want to, keep on rebuying. But when I started doing the research, and I've always, obviously because that it's a more wide field scope, I was interested in going for the nebulae, and the more I started reading up and learning about this new field of photography that I was venturing into, the more I realized that it would help a lot if I had a modified camera that could see closer to the infrared range. And I actually ended up buying a Canon specifically for that, the 60D DA that was already modified, and where the infrared filter is left off the sensor so that it can see, all the hydrogen nebulosity. And so it sort of evolved. So initially I just planned on getting the mount and a small little telescope so that I could see what I could do with it and learn of a fairly cheap setup. And then slowly but surely, it's sort of grown. And then I got I started seeing that, okay, now my limit is I'm not auto guiding. I can only do 30-second shots and I can't get enough detail out of a lot of the objects. I want to do longer exposures. So then the next thing you do is you get an auto guider. And, the Canon was already a surprise. I didn't think I was going to buy another camera, but I did, and then came the auto guider, and then you start playing and then you realize, oh, now I need, good acquisition software so that I can put my laptop on and tell it to, and a lot of these things you don't need, but it also, there's a lot of advantages. And I think everyone, dependent on your budget and what you want to achieve, you go along a certain route and then you try and stick to it. And the only thing that I've recently changed, the setup is still pretty much the same. here and there I added an accessory, and then eventually I just got a better telescope. And by better, I don't mean, you know, like a 2,000 millimeter that I can photograph distant galaxies with. I actually got a wider telescope than my GSO because I realized that a lot of these objects were in fact so large that I couldn't fit them into my fairly wide field telescope. And I then got a Williams Optics Star 71 refractor. So that, so it was actually wider than my initial scope, but it was just better quality. It was just a better quality scope, but still the cheapest refractor that they make. You know, so again, looking at the currency. And, you know, yes, I would have liked to get a nicer one, but that's the one I could afford, and that's the one I got.
I'm not familiar with the Williams Optics myself. Just out of curiosity, what is the price of that thing compared to, say, a really nice camera lens?
It's actually cheaper, and there's lots of advantages. To give an idea, Williams Optics is just one of those brands. There's a lot, but they're known for making really good quality optics. The more expensive brands that a lot of the astrophotographers go for would be something like Takahashi, which is, you know, two or three times the price. So again, I looked at, for the price, you know, the quality of telescope that they make, I liked. And to give you an idea, that's about $1,000 telescope. So it's not extremely expensive compared to a lens. If you buy a good prime lens, it would be, can be double or triple that. You know, I mean,
especially the sorts of focal lengths and apertures.
Exactly. I mean, I often, for wildlife photography, I often rent lenses because there's no way I could ever afford it. If I had to buy it, you know, so, and now, the nice thing about it being a telescope, even prime lenses aren't sharp to the edges and the stars distort and all of this. Whereas this Williams Optics now has five elements in it. It's got a field flattener built in. You know, it's got all the, it's designed to photograph stars and, you know, to do astrophotography. It was specifically designed for astrophotography, that specific scope. It actually comes, it terminates in a Canon mount, basically, on the other end. So they want you to put a Canon camera on the other end. So for that price, for $1,000, you would struggle to get a good Nikon or Canon lens at that focal length. Actually, it would be double or triple the price. So it actually made sense for me, rather than to use, because I've got a fair amount of lenses over the years doing photography. You know, you slowly but surely buy lenses, but it's a quite a fast little scope, and you know, it's got all the, it was built for astronomy, and the nice thing also, it's they even made it. Not all telescopes cater for full sensors. Not that I'm shooting with a full sensor at the moment, but it was designed to handle a full sensor DSLR without getting vignetting on the edges. So it's got a slightly larger than usual focusing tube to allow that. You know, so there's nice little extras like that, and it's tiny, it's very light, it's very small, it comes in a little carry case, you know, it looks like a small little bag that you can still sling over your shoulder, and that's your telescope. So it's only 350 millimeters, the Williams Optics. So, you know, and then you get a crop factor because of the crop sensor on the camera. But I mean, it's still it's tiny, and you know, most people would think that you can't do much of 350 millimeters, but, you know, actually, I do mosaics because it's not wide enough for some of the things I'm photographing, which is quite interesting. And that's, again, where the acquisition software now plays a role, because I've gone for slightly more technical software called Sequence Generator Pro that does the image acquisition. And you can do things like plate solving, and it has a mosaic wizard. And so beforehand, you can actually go and make some choices and look at the object you want to photograph and do your framing and get your coordinates and work out the overlaps and then shoot it in panels. And then afterwards, you can go and combine those images and end up with, you know, a much larger object than your telescope could shoot.
So will that help with the – will that instruct the mounts to
– Yes, it then takes control of everything. You basically you basically do – so you can download – there's a free plate solver that you can download the whole Sky database on your laptop. And then basically what you do is – you just randomly take an image. After you've aligned and everything, you go to your normal setup. Mm-hmm. You then slew close to where you want to be, and you take one frame of your camera, like a short exposure, 10 seconds or something. That then goes and compares the stars, and it plate solves, and it works out from this database exactly what your position is. And then as the software knows exactly, you know, basically where it is, and it works out the sky model from that. So it ignores your whatever you've done on your telescope mount. It wants to plate solve it for itself.
Oh, so the alignment that you're doing, it's just your polar alignment. You're not caring about...
Exactly. So it doesn't care about the alignment the telescope did then. So in a way, it syncs itself and then works out exactly where it is and how wide the field of view is that it's seeing and what angle you're at and everything. And from that, you can then basically let it slew to a target that you set up before. You could set it up at home, and it will then go and do the four panels for you, or eight panels, or whatever you choose.
That sounds very nice.
So, again, there's cheaper and there's free software that you can use. This was not an extremely expensive package, but I went that route just because it allows complete automation and flexibility, and I was interested in doing those kinds of images. Mm. So you'll actually see that a lot of my work is extremely wide shots. And that's, you know, so I've gone the opposite direction. People usually end up going, you know, for more powerful telescopes with, you know, more serious focal length.
Yeah.
I've actually gone, so I started with a 600 and now I'm sitting at a 350. Yeah. And the next thing I'd actually like to do is start doing more camera lens shots.
That was going to be my next question, actually. Is how long before you abandon the telescope altogether and just go for those nightscape Milky Way shots and...
I won't abandon it all the way, but what I'm actually looking at is, you know, getting a second mount maybe that I just put a camera on. Because, you know, it's also like I've already got that second camera, you know. So, again, it's a case of looking at what you've got and how you can use it. So instead of just sticking it on a standard tripod and doing a few Milky Way shots or something, how about putting it on a, you know, fairly inexpensive mount and just doing some wide-angle shots?
Mm.
You know, while you're busy tinkering on the telescope with something more complex, you know, your other scope can just be, because it's so forgiving if you go wide-angle,
yeah,
that it doesn't even need to be aligned all that accurately, and you still won't see, you know, the difference. So that's my current thinking, because I'm actually... You know, I would like to capture the whole of Orion, you know, and there's such a lot of interesting deep sky objects in that one patch of sky, you know, or around Antares, or there's just such a lot happening there. And, you know, so let this telescope concentrate on a detail and have a second mount, maybe, you know, doing wider shots of the whole area. And then... So that's the next thing I'd like, because that's sort of where it's heading, you know. But
All right. If we can maybe move away from the photography a bit,
yes.
I'm interested in your day job. Was it, you said you trained in graphic design, but you do what, animation, and is it visual effects or special effects, or what's the difference?
It's a combination. I studied graphic design because at that stage when I studied, you couldn't really study animation in the country. It was like, it was a field that was too new, and there wasn't really any animation schools or visual effects, you know, training facilities in the country.
Mm.
So everyone then advised me that, you know, because it's about creativity, go and either study photography or graphic design or fine arts or something in the creative, you know, field, and then specialize after that. So you basically train to get up to speed, and then you start specializing in an area. So I chose graphic design because computer graphics was part of that. At that moment, when I think when I sort of got to second year, that's when the whole desktop publishing revolution really started kicking in. You know, everyone started doing desktop publishing. Photoshop was released, some other programs that made, all of a sudden meant that people could start doing what companies did at their desktop at home. And I caught it right at that point, and I just took to computers. At that stage, graphic design was still airbrushing and, you know, doing a lot of stuff by hand. And even though I had the ideas, I just didn't like executing by hand, and I didn't have a very steady hand, which was not a good thing.
Right.
But on the computer, it didn't matter.
When you say by hand, do you mean as in like...
They would still use rotring pens and French curves and draw logos. Yeah, so, you know, that was really before the computer revolution took over the graphic industry. And a lot of things, so if you design someone a logo, you would sit there and you would draw it out on a piece of paper really large, use technical pens and French curves and compasses and, you know, do this design, and then make a negative of that and then make it smaller and to end up with a quality image that would get, you know, that the client would print. But the computer was changing that, and I got in right at the point where they got the first, at that stage, Apple computers. And, you know, that's when I was introduced to Photoshop. And by the time I finished studying, I knew that I didn't want to go and work in an advertising agency, and that I was more interested in computer graphics. And I was toying with the idea of 3D and moving graphics seemed to be the next logical step, you know. And I then decided that the only way that I was going to get into it in South Africa at that point was to do postgraduate studies, and then I would try and, you know, see what I could discover about the 3D process and do some 3D work. I mean, the lecturers didn't really know what to do with me, and they sort of left me to my own devices. And I then did my dissertation on 3D computer graphics, and, you know, that was my way to kind of have some time to do a lot of research and play around with the software and get into that. And when I finished studying, I then just took a chance and went to one of the animation companies with a very limited 3D portfolio, basically just my design work and an interest to learn.
Yeah.
And I was lucky, and the timing was right, and I got in. And then I was basically taught in-house to do computer graphics, mainly special effects for commercials, television commercials, and then later on for feature films.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's sort of the one thing led to the next. And what I do now is I supervise visual effects on films, but I'm still hands-on as well. And for the last few years, I've been heading a motion capture studio where you, so it's still in the line of animation, but basically where you would get actors, put them in suits, and it's cameras that pick up their motion, and that is then translated onto 3D characters.
Is that those suits with the ping pong balls on them?
That's okay. It, yeah. So basically it's a bunch of infrared cameras, and they bounce lights. There's a there's a glass bead coating on those balls, and it reflects back, and it's a bit like a GPS. If three cameras can see one ball, then it can work out the position. And we have 40 cameras, so you can have several characters interacting at the same time. And it captures their motion at a very high frame rate. And then that is, you know, that motion is captured and then transferred to computer-generated characters. And then we worked on animated TV series and feature films. So that's sort of what I've been up to lately.
Anything we would have seen?
A lot of the stuff goes to overseas. I mean, but the latest series that was shown at this stage only on ETV was called Silly Seasons, which is a children's television animated series. So it's probably more likely that the kids would have seen it rather than you.
I'll ask them. Yeah.
you're the wrong target market. So there's a. That was the latest series that we produced. So, it's, and I think that's also sort of where it overlaps. So, it's still generating images and working with images. It's just a different kind of thing, but a lot of the tools overlap, and that's where what also appealed to me. You know, a lot of the image editing software, like Photoshop, for instance, is something that I would use on a regular basis in my day job. And, you know, it's also something that you end up using for astrophotography. So that made it easier because it wasn't a new tool. It was something that, even though I'm using it in a different way, it was a tool that I was familiar with. That's basically the overlap.
Tell me, are you coming to Scopex this year?
Yes, I do plan to. Last year, I couldn't actually make it. I had something else on exactly at the same time. But I would like to, because I've never been, because I've only been at this for 2 years.
Right.
I think the first year I missed it, and the second year I couldn't make it. So I've never been, you know, so I definitely want to. Especially after the last one and the feedback I heard from everyone, I would definitely like to attend.
Yeah, you should bring some of your photos along and enter them in the competition there. I think you'll do well.
Yeah.
Because the standard has really climbed in the last few years.
It would have. Funny enough, I've never, the whole competition thing never really appeals to me too much. I'm doing it because I enjoy it. And that, I find sometimes, I mean, I know it's not the aim of this, it's to encourage people, but yeah. I often find that I do astrophotography because it's something I enjoy and I love the whole experience and working hard for that image and learning and, you know, because if that is more appealing to me than the competitive thing, where a lot of people I find are very competitive. And, you know, as soon as you start taking photographs, which is maybe something that they've been doing, they tend to like you less because all of a sudden there's new competition. But I'm not competitive in that way. You know, I do it for what I get out of it, and I don't really care too much about who thinks what. I keep my nose out of politics, basically. You know, so, and that's why I don't even often enter competitions like that. But this year, I mean, I'm actually having some prints made at the moment for different reasons. But, so I will have something. So I might as well.
It would be nice to, even if you don't enter, to sort of show people what you've been doing.
Yeah, I know exactly. So, I mean, at least that's one thing that's good. The internet as well. I put all my, just in general, put all my photography on Flickr because it's, a lot of photographers use it as a portal to their work. And, if you tag your images correctly, people can find it quite easily. So, you know, if you put it on a site like Flickr and you put some relevant data in, literally after you submit it, you can go and do a Google search and you'll find it, you know. So so that's I've always, try and get my images out on the internet as quick as possible. I really try and, put as much as I can on Flickr, whenever I get a gap. Because, years ago, I take a lot of images. I take a lot of photographs because I enjoy it, not just of astrophotography, but in general. And, it's not worth anything if it's lying on your hard drive and no one gets to see it.
Right.
So it's difficult sometimes with schedule and work and, like everything that's happening, but like I try and make time to, regularly do an image and put it on. Otherwise it means nothing if it's remains on my hard drive.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Do you find people copy your images and try steal them basically? It seems to be a problem once you get to a certain level. There's always some clown who wants to copy it and then post it on social media.
Yes, it happens a lot. That's another reason I use Flickr, because the image is officially copyrighted when you put it on a site like that, because I put it on and it's got the date that I put it on. I also tag the image. You can basically tag an image internally and it's embedded in the image. So you can, if someone takes one of your images, you can actually, my camera's serial number, my email, my website, everything is in that image. And if they don't know how to remove it, and very few people do, it will remain with that image, even if it's copied and re-downloaded and copied again. So it's easy to track, actually. And then the simple thing I do is I don't put my images on at full resolution. So I put it up high enough that you can get an idea of what the image is about. And then I share it, actually, as Creative Commons, which means you're allowed to download it.
Right.
You're allowed to share it. You can put it in your blog. I don't care. But you're not allowed to use it commercially. So, again, you can set the kind of licensing you want to apply to an image on Flickr. And that then is how you've licensed that image. It's as simple as that. So, so I choose Creative Commons, so you can, the type of Creative Commons that I've got is you can download it, you can save it, you can share it, but you're not allowed to use it commercially without my permission, and you're not allowed to change it. So what you do get, though, yesterday actually I saw someone that was using some of my macro photography, and that we just went and cropped my name off. But again, Google even knows it's my image because of all the embedded, EXIF and IPIC information that's in that image, and they, I can track it. So some cases, I'm not too worried about it, but like I always just feel it's a, especially for instance, some of my macro photography, they're of rare plants that I literally drove to Namibia to photograph, on my own cost. I buy all my own equipment. I partially do, even though it's not what I do for a living, I do sell a fair amount of images that are published. So, if you're going to use it commercially, then it's only fair to pay me for it. And that's, I think, how most photographers feel about it. If it's for educational use or, for a charity or whatever, by all means, you can use it free of charge. But like,
but that's all, just the courtesy of asking.
Exactly. And I mean, this guy was actually using it to sell these specific plants of this rare desert flower that I photographed, that I found on his site. But, you know, I won't even pursue it because you probably won't, you know, get anywhere. And I think a lot of them know it. They know it's a bit of work for you to now officially go and take them on, you know. So it's really, you know, it's not ethical, but like people do that, you know. And I think when you put images on the internet, you must always be aware of that.
Yeah.
And that's why you, I mean, I can still prove it's my image. I can still, my data is still embedded in the image. So I still, you know, I can still trace it, but sometimes it's not worth the effort. You know, I've got better things to do than that, you know. So, but yeah, my biggest form of control is that I don't allow, that I don't put large enough images on for people to print at any substantial size. So they could get a small print out of it, which is fine, but they can't, you know, go and really do publish it in a book. So that's your first level of control, and that's why I put it on at the rest that I do.
Okay. All right then. That's pretty much everything. If anybody wants to get hold of you or ask you some more about your images or contact you another way. Do you have a blog or, I suppose we can put links to your Flickr profile.
Yeah, you can. You can. I've got a website and I've got the Flickr page as well.
What's the website address?
It's anti-matter3d.com.
Okay.
So anti-matter3d, just with dashes in between anti and the 3d.com.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, because I tag all my images, if you do a Google search for my name and surname, you'll find me immediately. So that's also a quick way. If you just do a search for me on Google, you'll immediately see a lot of stuff.
Okay, good.
So it's not difficult to track me. But, yeah, I think the links, the Flickr link, and you can put my website link on as well.
Okay.
And that's just a general thing that has a bit of photography, a bit of work, a bit of everything on, you know, that leads to everything that I'm interested in. But
That was Martin Hagen, professional computer graphics wizard by day and expert astrophotographer by night. If you'd like to see some of his work, check out the show notes on urban-astronomer.com. And scroll down to the links. You'll find his website and his Flickr albums. I've also put his social media contact details for if you'd like to reach out to him and have a chat. If, on the other hand, you'd like to talk to me, well, by now you know what to do. Tweet me at @uastronomer or visit the Urban Astronomer Facebook page or mail me at podcast@urbanastronomer.com or just leave a comment on the show notes page. Oh, speaking of, a quick shout-out to Simon Fishley from the South African Astronomical Observatory, who pointed out an error I made in last week's episode. SALT, meaning the Big 10-meter Telescope at Sutherland, does actually not stand for the South African Large Telescope. It's the Southern African Large Telescope. So, yeah, sorry for helping to reinforce an already all-too-common mistake. If you pick up any other errors, please do let me know. Now, some exciting news. As you might be aware, this year's ScopeX Telescope and Astronomy Expo is scheduled for the 16th of September at its usual venue at the Military History Museum in Johannesburg. But what you probably didn't know is that I will be running a stand to promote ScopeX at the Icon Comics and Gaming Convention, starting in just a few weeks on the 16th of June at the Gallagher Estates Convention Center. If you'd like to come say hi, meet the face behind the voice, that's where I'll be. Now, it's important to remember that I'll be wearing my ScopeX hat, literally, but if you want to chat about the show or maybe ask a space or astronomy question you'd like me to answer in the show or whatever, you can find me at the ScopeX stand. I'll have my recorder with me, so if I've got the time, I might even put you on the show. Wouldn't that be fun? But before then, you'll have at least one more episode, which will be coming up next week. This one is another interview with Jen Millard. Jen is an astronomer who traveled to South Africa a few weeks ago to make exoplanet observations at the SAAO's site in Sutherland. She's a podcaster herself on a show that I've been a fan of for ages, Awesome Astronomy, so I'm rather excited to have scored this interview with her. She's really interesting, and I learned a lot from our conversation, so you really don't want to miss that one. So, until next week then, thank you for listening, and clear skies.